Grizzly One.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Legalize it. Don't criticize it.
7 minutes after the hour of 5, yours truly, Curtis Sliwa, taking you all home in the Drive Home at 5. And as it exists right now across both sides of the Hudson, the very restrictive medical marijuana law in effect in New Jersey, where the governor, Chris Christie, is not at all in favor of it. But then here in New York State, the program is almost unknown because it's out of sight, out of mind, and does not involve any smokable product, but only edibles and oils and candies. But on the line is a gentleman who says by 2018, it may well be a game changer if New Jersey decides to legalize recreational marijuana. He is the president of the New Jersey State Senate, Stephen Sweeney. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5, Stephen.
Thanks for having me, Curtis.
Okay, so what is it that has so moved you that you're advocating the recreational use of marijuana in New Jersey?
The numbers, Curtis. 28,000 direct jobs, an industry that is now that is unregulated, that becomes regulated, and is managed in a very professional form. Reduction in opioid use. In Colorado, opioid use is down 27%. Marijuana arrests are down 81%. I mean, the numbers are, you know, the numbers are just so impressive. And when we went to Colorado and you go to a store, you could eat off the floor. The security is phenomenal. And when you walk in the store, you would think, some people think, oh, there's a bunch of drug addicts. They're your neighbors. I mean, they're your neighbors. So it's an industry that it's time to, you know, legalize, regulate, and bring under in the mainstream. It takes place now.
Well, as you know, Stephen Sweeney, there's some doubting Thomases out there would suggest the money made from the sale and the taxing of the product marijuana for recreational use might not be good enough to offset the public health problems, particularly as Governor Christie has said he believes that it's a gateway drug to the use of more potent drugs. What did you discover when you went to Colorado?
What we discovered was there's no evidence of that at all, that we haven't seen this as a gateway drug. It's, most people, it's recreational. They're allowed to smoke it in their homes. And instead of dealing with the black market industry, you're actually bringing in it out of the darkness into the sunlight. Again, we looked at a lot of issues that have been raised. In Colorado, look, it's in its infancy stage. It's only 3 years. It's only 3 years old, but they've done a lot in 3 years. They're changing the packaging on the edible products because they don't want kids to be attracted to them, not that they can get in the stores. The guy that's leading charge for us, Nick Scutari, Senator Nick Scutari, didn't have his ID when I went to the store with him. He could not get in the building. So, you know, they really manage it well, and they've regulated. In fact, it's an industry that's asked for more regulation than they really would need. So it's what I saw was all positive, and the one thing the legislators from Colorado pointed out to us was, look, $200 million or $250 million in a $34 billion budget, it's not fixing the budget, but you could use it for some positive things like early childhood education expansion, and a lot of other things that would be good. So all the way around, we didn't see anything to deter us from moving forward. And it's not like we went in there looking at just for the positives. We wanted to know the good, the bad, and the ugly. And Colorado's done an outstanding job.
Now, who is it that's permitted to dispense marijuana as a recreational drug in Colorado? and where does he get manufactured?
Well, in Colorado, it's locally controlled. So local governments are the ones that would be, you know, issuing licenses within their community. Obviously, the state will have to set up a standard on what you can or how many dispensaries could be in the town. You know, in Colorado, there are places where there is not legalized marijuana. They've left it to the local communities to decide whether they want it or not.
Now, the business owners themselves, what is the profit ratio? The person who obviously invests in opening up the dispensary and purchasing the product and then selling it to the customer, and what's the percentage, the take that the actual state gets per purchase?
Well, that would actually be done through legislation, the percentages and everything else. Remember, you don't want to price it to a point where you drive someone to an illegal market. You want to bring people to the, you know, out of the black market into a legal process. And in Colorado, at this point, they feel 2/3 of all marijuana sales are now done legally. The profit margins are basically set on the market. But I can tell you, Curtis, I saw an industry that they can track, and they have software, they track every single plant. They know how much they weigh before they're cut. They know how much they weigh after they're cut and dried. And it was such an impressive tour that we did. And look, this is the infancy stage. 10 years from now, it'll be completely different.
Now, can you imagine in the future, because obviously the big initiative in your state, New Jersey, this election cycle is whether to expand casinos, possibly two to northern New Jersey, one by the Meadowlands Trotter Track, and another that might be put in a skyscraper to be built in Jersey City. You imagine in the future that the cocktail waitress is coming around feeding you drinks and then offering you cigars, cigarettes, tipperillos, and joints?
No, not at all. In fact, in Colorado, what they did is they kept it separate. They kept it separate in Colorado. And right now, all you can do is smoke if you purchase it legally is in within your home. So when you go down the streets, I walk past a dispensary, a store. You didn't even know it was there. So, no, it's not going to be. We will regulate it in a way. The one thing Colorado told us was that they had to do it through a constitutional amendment, which when you find out you made a mistake, it's hard to correct. You know, there's a lot of work, and you have to amend the Constitution again. We intend to do it legislatively, which will give us the flexibility that if we find problems, we can address them quickly.
And then final question. I know that as president of the New Jersey State Senate, Stephen Sweeney, when it was thought you might be a candidate for the Democratic nomination to be governor, you've since said you won't run against Murphy. But you have pushed the initiative that we're seeing advertisements about galore on TV, both for and against the increased number of casinos in the state of New Jersey. Polling seems to indicate it isn't doing too well. If it does not pass, what is the reality of what will happen to Atlantic City?
Well, I think it hurts Atlantic City in the long term because we were looking at that revenue out of casinos in the north to actually help rebuild Atlantic City. Look, there's never been a poll since 1979 that showed any positive feeling for casinos outside of Atlantic City. In fact, the first time the question was put up where it could be casinos could be anywhere in New Jersey, it failed. It only passed when it limited to Atlantic City. I would love to see it be successful for one reason. I think it gives Atlantic City the revenue to recreate itself, and in a state that doesn't have a lot of resources, Atlantic City needs resources, but, you know, the voters will make that decision, and whatever they decide, you know, Curtis, will be it. That'll be the final say.
Do appreciate that. That is the president of the New Jersey State Senate, Stephen Sweeney. Originally, it was thought he'd be running for the governorship to replace Chris Christie, whose term limited out, but he stepped aside, said he will not seek the Democratic nomination. It's Murphy and Murphy alone right now. And I can imagine a future, right, with a few casinos who survive in Atlantic City because this initiative will not pass. It's already down 70% in the polls. People don't seem to want an additional two casinos in the Meadowlands racetrack area and in Jersey City that would then send about half of its revenue back to the failing Atlantic City casinos. But I could see it in the future. It's almost like a scene out of Casino, you know, where you have De Niro and Pesci walking the floor of the casino. And the cocktail waitress saying cigars, cigarettes, Tipperillos, booze, and joints. Oh, yeah, I know. Look, you can't smoke in all parts of the casinos in New Jersey. But in some of the parts, you're able to smoke.
Curtis Sliwa.
Between the Scylla and Charybdis of commentary.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
Our 24, as we continue here on the drive home at 5. The blazing headlines in Saturday's Post says it all as the hotel industry wins. And the governor of the state of New York was flexing because he okayed the law to wallop the Airbnb hosts. On the line to discuss the ramifications is Pauline Frommer. She's the co-president of Frommer Media LLC, and she is the hostess of the Frommer's Travel Show that you can hear each and every Saturday right here at WABC from 3 to 4. Thanks for joining us again here on the Drive Home at 5, Pauline.
Oh, I'm happy to do so. This is an issue that's close to my heart, I got to say.
All right, so for the non-cognoscenti, for those who really don't know much about Airbnb, could you explain how it exists and how it operates?
Well, Airbnb is one of a couple of companies that allows individuals to either rent out a room in their house or apartment or rent out the entire house or apartment. Right now, Airbnb has more beds than every of the major hotel chains combined. It's been wildly popular, I think, because it allows people to use an asset they own and make a little extra money on the side. And I think it's terrible. I think this bill penalizes people who aren't breaking any law that I think should be a law.
Okay, what does it permit, though, you as the owner of the apartment or the house to do?
Well, it permits you. Airbnb is basically an advertising platform, and you can tell people coming to the New York City area, hey, I have an apartment for rent. I have a room for rent. The law of New York State says it's illegal to rent an apartment for less than 30 days unless the owner is on property. So that's where people are getting walloped, and they are going to be charged as much as $7,500 for violating that law. And it's also a free speech issue because they're going to be looking at Airbnb, and if they see an ad for your apartment, they're going to hit you with a fine.
But those that were the sponsors of this measure, who consisted of not only the New York hotel and motel trades, but also the Real Estate Board of New York, they lined up against the rental service because they said the short-term deal is hurting the hotel business while taking affordable residential units off the high-priced housing market.
Yeah, that's the big argument on the other side, and it's hard to know. Everybody I know who does Airbnb, I know a lot of out-of-work actors who do it. You know, an actress goes and stays with her boyfriend for a week so she can make the rent that month by renting out an apartment. But they say that it's not just the little people, that people are taking entire blocks of apartment off the market. And yeah, we do have a tight housing market. But I think that the law is just too blunt a force. There has to be a difference between somebody who's renting 20 apartments and making money as you know, in this kind of illegal hotel, and the little guy who every once in a while rents their apartment so they can make a little extra money. I can't believe there isn't some way that we can distinguish between those two entities.
Now, if you have a problem, let's say you own a home and you're renting an apartment the normal way, it's tenant-landlord court to resolve that dispute. If you have a problem with a no-tell, motel, Holiday Inn, whatever, you have some recourse. You could go to the Attorney General's office, I guess, if all else failed, the State Attorney General's office. But if all of a sudden a deal goes bad on a Airbnb agreement, where do you go to get relief if, in fact, you are the renter and the person who had posted the offering was not really truthful and didn't deliver on what was expected?
Well, you go to Airbnb, and they've done a pretty good job, I think. I mean, on the site, there are reviews, not just of the hosts, but of the people who are renting. So if a host gets too many complaints, the service removes them. Are there going to be bad actors? Sure. I think there will be in any marketplace, especially one that's as huge. But for the most part, I've done it many times. I've gone all over the world staying at Airbnbs, never had a problem, paid much less than I would have for a hotel room, and stayed in really interesting places, in real communities. I think that's what so many travelers are looking for, and that's why this has been popular. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. It's not just New York who's made Airbnb illegal. It's Barcelona, it's Paris. It used to be San Francisco. They actually changed the law to allow it now, but it's an ongoing issue.
Now, explain to me, what kind of financial differential are we talking about? As you've talked to Pauline, you traveled the world, you've taken advantage where Airbnb exists, you're in someone's home as opposed to, let's say, five-star, four-star hotel. What is the difference in terms of the price, ultimately, for your vacation or your business trip, and also the amenities?
The difference can be dramatic in price. I mean, you go to an expensive city. I was in Seattle. I rented an Airbnb. I think it was $125 a night. I probably would have paid double that for a place as well located, as spacious, and as nicely maintained. I also saved money because I could cook some of my own meals. In terms of the amenities, well, you don't have a concierge if something goes wrong. You know, if your toilet starts to overflow, you can't call the bellman to come fix it. You could probably call the owner, but that could take a while. So you don't have that helping hand. You're more on your own, but you get double the space. You get cooking facilities. You get some really interesting places.
Now, before that, somebody might have contemplated a bed and breakfast locale as opposed to an Airbnb. What is the difference there?
Well, a bed and breakfast is usually a little hotel. So it would be a place where there were maybe four bedrooms that were being rented out, where breakfast is provided. Usually you don't get breakfast with an Airbnb, where there's doilies on the furniture and it's very quaint and pretty. That's the classic B&B, and that's where Airbnb took their whole model.
And in fact, Airbnb has suffered a major setback at the hands of Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Bruta Cuomo, King Cuomo I. Although the forces that support Airbnb have said there will be some kind of legal retaliation at least sometime in the future. That was Pauline Frommer, and she is the hostess of the Frommer's Travel Show. You don't want to miss it every Saturday from 3 to 4 right here at WABC.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Guardian Angel founder Curtis Sliwa.
WABCRadio.com.
I don't care. I shot right by with my tail in the air.
You'll see so many signs that are up with skull and crossbones, danger. It's an area where the Department of Health has sprayed some toxic chemicals to eliminate the rodent, rat, and mice problem. Oftentimes, you'll go down into the subway system, and as you're awaiting the arrival of your train, you see rats right on the end of the platform, sometimes doing the Harlem Shuffle and the Crypt Dance, almost oblivious, almost as if they've become resistant to whatever chemicals are being used to eliminate them. And now an old-school approach being used at the state-run Jacob Javits Center, in which they're using feral cats on-site to keep the rats, the mice, and the rodents away. On the line to discuss it, Kathleen O'Malley, Director of Education Feral Cat Initiative. Thanks for joining us here on The Drive Home at 5, Kathleen.
Hey, thanks for having me, Curtis.
What exactly is the Education Feral Cat Initiative, Kathleen?
Well, it's the NYC Feral Cat Initiative, and I'm the Director of Education. I run a program whereby we educate as many people who are taking care of feral and stray cats as we possibly can. Because if people are feeding feral and stray cats out there, it means that the cats are going to be able to breed out of control that much easier. So we want to teach them the humane method of population control called trap, neuter, return, or TNR. And that's one of our main functions, to teach people TNR and hook them up with free services from the nonprofit organizations around the city. Ours included. The NYC Feral Cat Initiative is a program of the Mayor's Alliance for NYC's Animals, but we're a private nonprofit. We work closely with the city, but we're not part of the city.
Well, how do you overcome, though, that stereotype, as you had mentioned, an older woman, we'll call her the local cat lady, feline lady, or tomcat lady in the neighborhood. She comes out, she feeds the cats each and every day, and from that colony of cats, all of a sudden you see 40, 50, 60
exactly.
kittens.
Yeah.
How do you get them to the point where somebody is feeding them on a regular basis, and then you're able to spray them and neuter them so it doesn't become a tremendous burden?
Well, first of all, it's not just little old ladies. It's people of every age, all kinds of ethnicities, men, women. You know, there are old ladies out there feeding cats, and they may not be able to physically lift up traps and do that part of the trapping. But we encourage them to get hooked up with a team of people, because there's usually not just one person feeding the cats. It's usually several people in the neighborhood feeding the cats, and we try to get them to be aware of each other so they can work together and get these cats all fixed. And then the population stabilizes, and they don't go anywhere. They stay in place, keep feeding them, and they'll stay in place. They'll defend the territory against new cats coming in, and they'll also keep the rodents at bay. You know, and that brings us to the Javits Center. You know, usually in the neighborhood, people like to have the cats around, not too many, but they like to have the population under control and keep the cats around so that they will keep the rats and mice away from their homes or away from their gardens. There are a lot of community gardens around the city that have feral cat colonies. They just kind of quietly do their job keeping the mice and rats away. And because they're feral, that means that they're afraid of people. They don't really want to be close to us, but they want to live near us because we're a source of food for them.
Now, Kathleen, the rats here in this city and in some other major urban areas sometimes are the size of cats. Now, I've never seen a cat take on a rat, a huge rat. Do they kill the rats?
Not usually. Usually the presence of a group of cats is enough to make female rats decide to make their nest elsewhere, and then the males follow them, because you know, the big, you know, almost cat-sized rats are not going to be that much afraid of cats, but baby rats are certainly vulnerable to cats. So that's what's going on there. It's just the survival instinct.
And we're gonna run into a bad patch of weather soon, where it's really cold, inclement, sleet, ice, snow, sometimes sub-freezing weather. How do these colony cats survive that?
Well, one of the things that we teach, that's a really good question, when we teach trap, neuter, return, we also teach people how to take care of their colonies, how to get them to survive the harsh weather of winter. We have on our website, www.nycferalcat.org, we have information about how to make really simple, easy-to-make shelters that are insulated against the cold. The cats will sleep in them. And believe me, those shelters save a lot of lives in the winter.
And a lot of time, they're like styrofoam boxes that you've contoured into a living facility for the cat, right?
Yeah. You can take like an Omaha steak shipping box, just cut a little hole in it for a door, put some straw bedding in there. You can get straw this time of year pretty easily. You know, people are having Halloween festivals. They have these bales of straw sitting around. You can probably pick some up off the curb after one of these festivals, and it makes good warm bedding for the cats.
Well, not only that, it's perfect sweat equity, because in return for the lodging and being taken care of, the feral cats will keep the rats, the mice, and the rodents away. By the way, if you'd like to learn more about the program, we've just initiated an animal protection division of the Guardian Angels. You can go to the Curtis and Kuby Facebook page, and you'll see our director, Nancy Regula, with her own colony of cats that she has presided over for 10 years in Sunset Park. And clearly, it is a way in which the human can live side by side with the cats and everyone benefits. I mean, look at the Jacob Javits Convention Center, the conventional way of getting rid of rats, rodents, and mice were not working. So now they're using what we used to call street cats, tomcats, feral cats.
Curtis Sliwa, the deepest knowledge of the city. The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
Dr. King, Malcolm X, freedom of speech is as good as sex. Abe, Lincoln, Jefferson, Tom,
I gotta listen to this baton again, Madonna. Well, I'm not the only one out there who doesn't like her. Apparently, Lady Gaga despises her, loathes her, and hates her. But it's the intro to our election special reports. And Noam Layden, our news director, who also does a great show in the morning before I miss in the morning. You can't miss him 5 to 6. Many of you have just reconnected as you've gotten back into your cars, your pickup trucks, your vans. In leaving early this morning, you should really catch up to Noam early before you hit Imus in the morning. But Noam, you had a great series last week. What's in store for us this week?
Oh, well, you got it is round number 2 that starts tomorrow, right on your on the drive home, and then you also can hear it on the news hour. It's Deborah Valentine, one of our longtime correspondents, and she's going to take a look back, because it's not too early to do this, by the way. She's going to take a look back at the best moments of the 2016-2015 presidential campaign. And when you start to dive in, Curtis, it's unbelievable, because you say to yourself, okay, I know what some of the highlights were, but it's unbelievable how much has happened in the last year and a half. I mean, and a lot of it pretty comical, by the way.
Oh, yeah. In fact, the old gray lady in the New York Times, if you went to the guts of the paper today, they've got like 4 pages of microscopic print of all the tweets that Donald Trump sent out ever since he announced 18 months ago.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you should mention that. So I was going through all the tweets over the last year and a half, and this is one that somehow I missed, but I think it's great. He wrote, one of his tweets was, if Hillary can't satisfy her husband, what makes her think she can satisfy America? I think that's a great tweet. Somehow I missed that one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, remember, they come fast and furiously, but what were some of the other ones?
Well, you know, look, there were moments for Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail, but just honestly, there wasn't as many. I mean, Donald Trump really was the king of this whole presidential campaign. Whether it gets him to the White House or not, that's another story. But when you look back at the highlight moments that people will remember, there are moments like when during the debate, during the GOP debates last year, when he talked about Carly Fiorina, you know, his one-time foe, gave this interview to Rolling Stone where he said, look at that face, referring to the fact that she wasn't so attractive. Of course, his battle with Megyn Kelly over at Fox News, blood coming out of wherever, remember that quote that he made? I don't like people who are captured when talking about John McCain, who, of course, was you know, prisoner of war for 5.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton being tortured. But then, you know, this was all like a year ago he said this. This wasn't even recent history. If we go back, you know, 2 weeks ago, we can find great stuff. But a year ago, he was saying stuff that was at that time considering very controversial. But, you know, it absolutely propelled him forward in this whole Republican primary into where he is today.
All right, so an election special that you'll hear the next few nights on the drive home at 5. And then also on the Noam Layden program from 5 to 6 in the morning before I miss in the morning. From Donald Trump on that RNC convention stage in Cleveland. Well, actually, it was the debate stage first with Megyn Kelly saying he would not take the pledge to back a Republican. To Donald Trump now saying he would not take a pledge to back the election results. One thing you could say about him, he's been consistent.